It's time to go in depth on WTOP with Ask the Governor. Your questions for Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Now live from the Glass and Closed Nerve Center, your hosts, Deborah Feinstein and Mark Lewis.
To be a part of the program and ask your question of Virginia's Governor Bob McDonnell, call us at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. You can email us at WTOP.com. We're also taking questions on our Facebook page. Send a tweet using the hashtag AskThe.
The Virginia General Assembly sent 812 bills to the governor for his consideration. And midnight last night was the deadline for him to act on those bills. And we understand the governor was up at midnight last night looking them over. The General Assembly reconvenes next week now for their veto override session to consider the governor's amendments and vetoes.
Governor, welcome back to WTOP. We know at the top of your list was that big $800 million transportation funding package. Lots of considerations to make. What changes did you make to that bill?
Well, first, Mark, thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it. And General Assembly sends me a lot of bills every year, 800 to 900 every year that I've been governor. And I've got 30 days by the Constitution to do thorough legal and policy reviews, plus the budget, which is an extensive document. Obviously, one of the significant things that was done this year was to, at my request, enact a long-term sustainable transportation funding solution that'll resolve our challenges for the next generation. Having grown up here and all of you driving here, you know that this is the most congested area of the country, and that the transportation funding challenges have significantly impaired quality of life, job creation, our ability to attract and retain employers here. And so I told the General Assembly session this year at the beginning, don't leave home without getting this bill done. So they passed a modified version of the bill that I proposed, and but I did make some amendments. The bill, good news is, what coming to me honored a lot of the principles that I had in there. One is that I wanted to eliminate the gas tax because it's a reducing government, reducing revenue source because of inflation and alternative fuels. They cut it by 35%, which is good, and it will have the lowest gas taxes, I think, in the continental United States now at about 10.5 cents a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they used a lot of general funds, $200 million of current general funds, about $200 million of future general funds that will come from the passage of some federal laws. Thirdly, they did have this alternative fuel vehicle fee so that people that use other types of vehicles that don't use gas will pay something towards the use of the roads. And thirdly, and finally, they replaced it with a sales tax that is grows with economic growth as opposed to the gas tax, which declines. So I made made changes in four areas. One was technical. We have a lot of eyes on these bills, from lawyers to legislative services, and there was a number of things that had to be changed technically to make the bill read right. Secondly, was administratively, with some new fees and some new taxes, we had to change some of the ways the administration of the program worked. So administrative changes were made. Thirdly, is based on legal advice from the Attorney General's office, from our own in-house counsel, and other legal analysis. We determined that to make sure that the bill was fully constitutional and defensible, that we had to make some changes. And that was to deal with the special legislation provision of the U.S. Of the Virginia Constitution. It says you can't have that without basically a two-thirds vote. And you have to have some rationale for imposing different tax rates in different parts of the state. So we made some changes there. So instead of specifying regional regions of the state for these regional taxes, we specified criteria, i.e. planning district commissions, population, number of registered vehicles. So empirical criteria as opposed to naming regions, I think that's going to help.
So you're allowing immensely. It statewide versus just in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads.
But only right now, only Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads could qualify, I think, based on these criteria. So that doesn't change. But you cannot, we did not believe, just go ahead and outright name regions. I think it's got to be done on empirical criteria based on really congestion-related factors.
And your last provision, and then we have to break for traffic. What was your last
Well, the change? Fourth area was the policy changes, and I was concerned about the tax rates. A number of these taxes that were increased were not ones that I had proposed. So I've changed the titling tax from 3.3% to 4.15%. I've ratcheted down the hybrid fee or the alternative fuel vehicle fee from 100 to 64. Mm-hmm. And then the two taxes that were raised just too much here in Northern Virginia was the hybrid transmit occupancy tax, reduced it from 3 to 2, and then reduced the rate on the grantor's tax, which still raises the same amount of money, but we've reduced the rate because they used old projections in the bill. So altogether, it does about the same good for transportation, but it ratchets down the tax burden.
All right, we're the hour at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. You can email us at WTOP.com or send a tweet using the hashtag AskThe. Deb and I are also joined by Hank Silverberg, our WTOP Virginia reporter. Governor, we are focusing right now on the transportation package and the amendments that you have made to it. Do you think, can you explain to us how the changes that you have made meet the concerns that were raised by the Attorney General about the constitutional status of this taxing authority?
Well, I've been talking to the Attorney General now for many weeks, and my staff primarily are the lawyers in my staff and theirs, to talk about issues that they had raised. But we've also raised a number of them on our own, and looking at some of the litigation from 2007 and 2008 and a number of cases over the years. Road litigation is not uncommon in Virginia.
Right. It seems just, we've been at this spot before.
Well, we have, but I mean, not only on bills that pass, but anytime there's major projects that are built, there's litigation. So this is almost commonplace. But our goal was to make sure that it was as defensible as possible. One of the issues was this issue of special legislation, that if you pass legislation that's aimed only at particular regions or a city of the state and it's named in particular, then it requires a much higher vote total in order to do that. So we wanted to be sure that it was not intended to be special legislation. You remember my original bill only dealt with a statewide solution.
Right.
But in the conference report, they actually added on these regional solutions. So this was not our language, although we certainly understand Hampton Roads in Northern Virginia got special problems and need some special authority. And so the conference committee crafted this language, and then it was up to me with legal advice to address it. So we've made the changes that don't say that there are special taxing authority for Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. We say that it's based on specific criteria that theoretically could be met by any region of the state. Mm. And it's based on the confines of a planning district commission, based on the population of a region, based on the transit ridership, based on the number of motor vehicles that are registered in that region. Those are all indicia of congestion. And of course, Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, number one and number 20 in the Texas Institute survey, far and away the most congested areas of the state, and Northern Virginia number one in the country. And so we've spelled out what we think is a very clear rational basis for separating taxes in one area of the state that don't apply in other areas of the state, and that's based on the legal advice that we've gotten. I think these are the right calls that will strengthen the bill.
Hank?
Oh, I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on the radio. Was it the reason for you making these changes was the Attorney General, who wants your job and is running for the position, was not on board with the way things were set up. He didn't think it was constitutional, and the state would have faced a lawsuit, an awkward position that he might have had to defend if it went through.
Well, look, I was Attorney General of Virginia myself, and I had to defend my clients. Maybe I didn't necessarily agree with their policy position. But as the Attorney General, your job is to defend your clients. And if there's an overwhelming conflict, then you get outside counsel. A couple times I've had it, you know, we've done that. But Attorney General raised some issues on policy grounds. But the advice that we get from the Attorney General's office is advice that we incorporate into our review on every bill, Hank. They review every bill and give us comments. And there were a number of other amendments that I made in legislation that was based on legal advice from the Attorney General's office. But I've got my own attorneys in the office as well. I've got a legal counsel. I've got my chief of staff who's a lawyer. My secretary of transportation's a lawyer. So they gave me their independent judgment as well. And the amendments that I made in that area of the bill, primarily dealing with the legal issues in the regions, the statewide component didn't really have any legal or constitutional issues. It was these regional components that were crafted by the conference committee.
But it was designed to avoid the same kind of lawsuit that you had the last time around when the thing got thrown out.
Well, but that was for different reasons. I was Attorney General, and the governor at the time did not ask me for advice. Had he asked me for advice, we might have had a different result. But that was because he allowed not local governments, but local MPOs to actually impose taxes, and the court said that's unconstitutional. And that was the issue there. This is a different constitutional issue, but it's still a legal issue. You're correct, dealing with either special legislation or a rational basis for differential tax rates. So it's a different thing we were trying to fix, but I believe that we have strengthened the bill.
Are you and the Attorney General on the same page now with these changes?
I mean, we don't ask for his permission. We ask for his advice, and we've taken his advice on this and many bills. And we've got our own analysis. We have lawyers. We take our own analysis, and we've crafted that. But Mark, what's really important here is for 27 years we've been talking about how do we fix the problems, particularly in Northern Virginia. I grew up here in Northern Virginia, Fairfax County. I lived for 21 years in Virginia Beach, raised all my kids in Hampton Roads. And for most of the time that I've been in the legislature or attorney general or governor for 22 years now, we've talked about how do we fix transportation. We've done a lot the last couple of years to do that with bonds and everything from offshore drilling proceeds to surplus and a number of other things. But this is now, for a generation, I believe, we're going to be able to improve the quality of life, to create new jobs, to be able to keep people out of traffic and more time with their kids' ballet lesson and doing homework and less time stuck in traffic in Northern Virginia. You've seen some progress already, but these changes in the law now will do a lot of positive things. Is it going to cost a little more? Yes, probably $20 a person statewide, maybe as much as $100 a person in the locality. So we've ratcheted down some of the tax burden with my amendments, but I think this will help long-term to create a more competitive and a more job-friendly Virginia.
Back with Governor.
Governor Bob McDonnell and you. Now more of Ask the Governor and your hosts, Deborah Feinstein and Mark Lewis.
The number to call if you have a question for Governor Bob McDonnell, 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. You can email your question at WTOP.com. We're also taking questions on our Facebook page or send a tweet. Use the hashtag AskThem.
Governor McDonnell, we've been talking about some changes that you've made to a number of bills that have been sent to you for your consideration. The General Assembly coming back next week to take a look at those veto override session and consider your amendments. One of the issues that came up was texting while driving, and you now support making driving while texting a primary offense, which would allow police to pull somebody over for texting, plain and simple. Tell us about the changes that you made there to that legislation.
Yeah, I was initially concerned that whether or not we needed to have changes in the law and whether or not the current laws dealing with reckless driving and so forth were sufficient. But the General Assembly had years ago already decided that texting while driving was going to be a separate offense. They just made it a secondary offense, meaning you can't get pulled over solely for that. It's got to be incident to some other offense like reckless driving or speeding or something like that. So they've now made it a primary offense. But the problem that I had was they dramatically ratcheted up the fines, like 1,000%, from $20 to $250. And they had set the texting that leading to reckless driving at twice the mandatory fine of drunk driving. And I thought that was just way out of whack. I mean, texting while driving is dangerous, particularly for young people. The evidence is pretty clear that there are a number of accidents, injury, death that is caused by this activity.
So why not the higher fines?
Well, because 1,000% is just out of whack. And texting while driving is not more dangerous than driving drunk. So basically, that's why I adjusted the fines. I've made the mandatory punishment for mandatory minimum fine for texting while driving that is also reckless, $250, which is the same as drunk driving. And I've basically cut in half the fines for just purely texting while driving. I mean, in other words, not even leading to anything reckless or anything else that's wrong, but just the mere act of texting is gone. Now the fine will be, instead of $20, it'll be $125, which is still a huge increase. And I think it's done by the General Assembly as a deterrent. But I thought the increases were just too much and were completely out of whack with the whole rest of our traffic code. And, you know, having penalties that meet the offense are proper. I've also made some changes, though, to make sure we've got some training that's done with our law enforcement community through the Department of Criminal Justice Services, because this now creates the ability to have probable cause to stop someone for texting while driving. Well, what is that probable cause? Is it looking down at your lap?
Right.
Is it looking at a phone?
Mm-hmm.
You can under the law, unfortunately, the way it's written, you can make a phone call, you can look in your database, you can play, you can use your GPS, you can play tic-tac-toe, you just can't text or email. That's the way the law has already been written. And so there are just some things that I think we just need to make sure that are done right July 1st out of the blocks. And I think having some training and some agreement on the probable cause standards would be good.
There is training to try to discern the difference between a driver who's looking down at a phone and a driver who's down and texting. How are they going to figure that out?
Well, there will be. But this happens every time there's a new law because, listen, our state police and our local law enforcement authorities do just a great job, and they always have to make tough calls when it comes to things like a reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop and frisk somebody, like probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. It's easy if it's speeding. You know what? You got your radar.
Right.
If it's reckless driving, you got somebody swerving, you've got probable cause. This is a little different because you've got to find out, well, what is the conduct that would lead you to believe that someone is texting if you don't see a phone? So I think these are challenges that the law enforcement officers go through every time there's a new law is how do they get trained in it? And so this is what DCJS does, is helping to set standards for training for law enforcement.
You've expressed concern on this program before that you felt the reckless driving law, as stated, covered this behavior and that you didn't want a laundry list of other behaviors
That's
added
true.
To it. What changed your mind?
Well, it didn't change. That's not what the law actually ended up doing. I was looking at the final version of the bill, and all they do, they don't change that. All they do is to say that if the reason that you are convicted of reckless driving is based on the fact that you were texting or emailing at the time, they've just increased the penalties. And they've just increased the penalties for texting while driving, regardless of whether it leads to reckless. So it really wasn't a change in the substance of that criteria. The only difference is that it's now primary and not secondary. So that's why I looked at it as a penalty change primarily and not a not a change in the substance of the law.
Okay.
Reckless still, I think, would be covered.
Okay, but along those same lines, the same argument can be made about using and not using a seatbelt. All right. Although it may not affect the way you're driving, it does affect what happens to you in a crash. And yet there's total resistance to making that a primary offense.
Well, I think the logic over the years has been if you don't use a seatbelt, the primary problem is with you. If you text while driving or email while driving, then you create the opportunity for risk of injury or crash or death to another person. And so that's why I think the General Assembly decided to make this change.
All right, Governor McDonald, thank you. We'll be back with more of your questions and calls, 877-336-1035. Thanks for joining us here on WTOP Radio, Ask the Governor, with Governor Bob McDonald of Virginia. We're going to go to a phone call here. We're going to talk to Bim, who's calling from Maryland, with a question for the governor. Go ahead, Bim.
All right, thank you for taking my call. My question is, when you reduce the fuel tax and raise the purchase tax, now your policy is not affecting the non-drivers because the non-drivers are going to pay the fuel tax in another way for drivers. So it is affecting the non-drivers.
I do, yes. I mean, the whole philosophy behind the changes in the gas tax was that every state in the country and the federal government is faced with the dilemma that the fuels tax continues to decline. Our motor fuels tax is worth 45 cents on the dollar mark from 1987 when it was last raised. So we've really lost 55% of the ability to have road money for construction. During that time, asphalt binders gone up 350%. So we have a math problem. Everybody does. That's why infrastructure is crumbling around the country. You add in alternative fuels that don't use gasoline and higher fuel efficiency. It's gone from 10 to 27 miles a gallon in the last couple decades, heading towards 40 plus with CAFE standards. It's just a problem that gasoline tax is going to continue to decline, meaning less ability to build roads. So to answer his question, the choices that we made in the General Assembly this year is reduce the gas tax. In fact, I wanted to kill it completely, get rid of it. The General Assembly reduced it 35%, as I mentioned earlier. We're going to have the lowest gas taxes, I think, in the country, and replace it with a 5.3% sales tax, go from 5% to 5.3, and then have a slight increase in the diesel tax because that's primarily paid by out-of-state trucks, about 70-80%, and they do about 70-80% of the wear and tear on the roads. So, and the other thing is that we've had the sales tax go to transportation now for 27 years. A half a cent of the current sales tax already goes to transportation. And Mark, everybody benefits from the roads. Whether you drive or not, you get goods brought to market by trucks. You get your police and fire and rescue that come to your house by truck. So everybody benefits from the roads, regardless of whether you have a car. So we thought this was a fair way to make the transition from gas to a tax that grows with economic growth, not because of a tax increase, but economic growth, and that is the sales tax.
If you have a question for the governor, a couple of phone lines are open right now at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. Governor, we want to switch gears and ask you about what Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly has called a titanic political contest to land the new FBI headquarters, whether it'll stay in the district, possibly move to Virginia, possibly move to Maryland. 11,000 jobs at stake. There is property in Springfield that is being promoted by Fairfax County and Virginia authorities as what they think would be the primary spot. What can you tell us about what your role has been in this, and what do you think Virginia's chances are?
Well, obviously, we'd love to have that facility located here. They've got plenty of operations at Quantico and other places around the state. We've consistently made pleas to have both federal and private sector facilities relocate to Virginia. I can't tell you much more for a couple reasons. One, these details are obviously being pursued by our Department of Economic Development and others. And two, during the pendency of these kinds of discussions about attracting new business here, there's obviously things that I just shouldn't talk about because until things are finalized, we don't know whether things are going to work out for Virginia. Now, I will say there's broad agreement from our federal delegation and from our office that we'd love to have them here.
There's always a battle with Virginia and Maryland over
I call it friendly competition.
Friendly competition, if that's how you want to phrase it. Some are saying that that Maryland has a bit of an advantage with the connections of Governor O'Malley, a Democrat, Senator Barbara Mikulski, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, a Democrat, can call in some favors. What favors does Virginia have to call in?
I mean, this shouldn't be based on favors or connections. It should be based on what's in the best interest of the FBI. And as you know, there are multiple government training facilities already in Virginia. And whether co-location or location in Virginia that is already at a hub of much federal activities. You know, we have 19 federal military bases, multiple other non-DOD related facilities here. And we think we're a very friendly home for federal government installations. So that ought to be a factor. And we have lower taxes in Maryland.
Hank?
Yeah, we just need to clarify. The site in Springfield is not the only Virginia site that's being considered.
Right.
There's a Prince William County site. There's a Fort Belvoir site. There's several others. The folks in Prince William County would be very mad at me if I didn't mention that.
Yes.
and we saw in the Washington Post article recently, there are potentially some concerns with the Springfield site because there is some sort of CIA facility there that may be very difficult or very cost prohibitive to move that site in order to make room for the FBI.
I'm not talking about the CIA. I will only say that we very much are pursuing this. We'd love to have the FBI.
Is that
the
site
FBI
in jeopardy
in
because of that?
I don't really want to get into specifics about that because we've got our economic development and other people handling that. I can only say that there's broad agreement that we'd love to have the FBI hosted in Virginia, and we're going to do everything we can to make that happen.
Is there anything that gives Virginia the advantage to having the site in Virginia over the district or Maryland?
Well, I mentioned, they've obviously got, I think, some operations at Quantico and other places already. Around the state. We're going to have better roads here very soon that they can get to work a little bit better with the transportation bill. We've got lower taxes. And again, I think just the entire federal government infrastructure that we've already got in Virginia is one that's very conducive to adding the
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and you. Now more of Ask the Governor and your hosts, Deborah Feinstein and Mark Lewis.
To be a part of the program, call us now at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. If you have a question for Governor McDonnell, you can email your questions also at our website, WTOP.com, or on our Facebook page. You can tweet us using the hashtag AskThe. Governor, we've been talking about a lot of changes you have made to the bill sent to you by the General Assembly. One of them will now require a photo ID in order to vote in Virginia. If you don't have a driver's license or a passport, you'll have to cast a provisional ballot. We know you have also, or will also be ordering, we're told, an education campaign to get voters ready for this. What do you think about how this bill came together just so shortly after some changes were made in Virginia to what you needed to vote? And do you think it'll clear the Justice Department approval process?
The legislature has been working on ballot security measures for years and years. In fact, as long as I can remember, there was a bill that passed last year that clarified what kind of identification could be used in changing the provisional ballot measure that was implemented very successfully. As you know, I issued an executive order. We sent out ID cards to everybody. We had an education campaign. And we had, in the midst of a presidential election, 75% turnout. We had a very small percentage of people that were not informed and they didn't have the proper ID. So I think our citizens are very much paying attention to these laws. So this year, the General Assembly passed a change that actually required the ID to actually have a photograph. And obviously, that's the best way to make sure that the person that's appearing at the poll is, in fact, who they say they are. So we've reviewed that. I have signed the bill. I am also issuing an executive order now, as you pointed out, to engage in a public relations, public education campaign on how this will be implemented. It's not effective till elections after July of 2014, Mark. So it's still a year plus away. Probably the November, unless there's special elections, be November 2014, so a year and a half. The bill clearly calls for the issuance of a free photo ID. If anybody doesn't have one, you get one for free at your local registrar's office, which is what we did last year as well. So I think with those protections in there, that it's the proper balance. And here's the test is it's got to be a proper balance between enhanced ballot security to make sure that our citizens know that there's secure and honest elections and making sure that no one's right to vote is encumbered in any burdensome way by anything that we pass in the law. And I thought this bill passed the test. I think with the executive order that I've issued, with the training, the free IDs and everything else.
But why make the change? I mean, if you've told us and you've repeated again that there were very few problems other than the long lines, which is a separate issue.
That is a separate issue.
But why make that change on the heels of this? Of the change that was just made a year ago when you did not have significant problems in November.
First of all, the General Assembly passed the bill. So I've got to determine, is it an acceptable policy? I said there was good compliance with the bill last year. That doesn't mean it is sufficient scrutiny to be sure that when a voter shows up with a ID that does not have his or her picture, that is sufficient to be able to determine whether or not it is that voter. And so that's what the General Assembly did. Let's take it another step. Now, your other point, though, needs to be addressed, and that is that any law like this will have to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department or by a federal court. Mm-hmm. And so there's a year and a half to go through all that, and all that process is up to the Attorney General. Just as an aside, as you know, there's also a case in the United States Supreme Court right now on the whole issue of pre-certification by Virginia and other states. So the answer is I thought the bill did properly balance the ballot security and honest election requirement with any civil liberty or impediment to voting concerns, and that the fact that there's a free ID, just like we had last year, and we're going to have a sustained voter education campaign, I think that will be implemented just fine.
Governor, you'll get an argument on whether photo ID had an impact on the long lines. A report just issued in Fairfax County last week.
Well, there was no photo ID last year.
But although most people, it was an ID, though.
It was ID.
And one of the problems was the poll workers were not quick enough. People had to show ID. That slowed down the lines. That made the lines longer. Now you're adding another factor, photograph. Okay, so my question is, what's being done to shorten those lines? I mean, that's the improper number of poll workers. There were all kinds of problems, and the photo ID just slows it down even more.
Well, I would disagree with that. In fact, I think it speeds it up more. Here's why, Hank. Number one, the reason that we had long lines is because American democracy is alive and well. We had 76% of the people turn out to vote last year in a robust presidential election. In Northern Virginia, it was longer than that. But everybody got to vote. I'm very concerned having people wait in line an hour and a half, 2 hours. I wait in line an hour and a half in Richmond to cast my vote, so I was in that myself. But it was 2 hours, 3 hours in some places up here. That's unacceptable. So we've got the State Board of Election looking at that. What I would suggest to you is for people under the old law that did not have an ID, they would actually have to fill out a provisional ballot or sign an affidavit saying they are who they say they are. That actually slows things down. If you've got the right ID at the polls, you actually speed things up because it's a quick showing of the ID and you're on and not having to fill out some other form. So that's why last year, Hank, I issued new voter IDs to every citizen in Virginia and did a voter education campaign. And that's the same thing that's happening with photo ID. The bill itself says free photo ID to anybody who doesn't have one and can't afford one. And secondly, is an education campaign. So I really look at this as an advancement that will not in any way slow things down, actually speed things up.
Governor, if I'm correct, when this cleared the House of Delegates, only one Democrat supported the measure. Why do Republicans find this change so urgent? And can you point to a rise in voter fraud in Virginia to any degree that would necessitate the change?
Well, there's another way to ask that question, and that is why don't Democrats want to make sure that you have better ballot security and better integrity in elections when it doesn't encumber the rights or the ability of anybody to be able to vote? Mark, as you know, I am a strong supporter of making sure that we maximize voter participation. I talk to young people about it all the time. I've restored more civil rights than any governor in the history of the state because I believe people— one, ought to have second chances, and two, ought to have every reason, every ability to vote. I believe in that deeply. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do everything we have to make sure we have free and honest elections. One of the great things about America, people don't trust elections in other places in the world because sometimes they're a farce. Not here in Virginia, not here in America. And so having a little bit of enhanced security is a very, very small administrative change that will, I believe, that will be made. The IDs will be issued for free. I think recent surveys have shown that 70-75% of Virginians, Democrats and Republicans, support having photo ID. Most people brought photo IDs to the polls anyway, Hank, last year, because that's the IDs that they've got. It's a government ID. It's a driver's license. Most people have them anyway. So this is not going to be, I think, a big change. If you don't have one, you get it for free at your local registrar's
office. What do you need if you are someone who does not drive, you don't have a driver's license, you don't have a passport? What do you need to secure that in Virginia in order to get one?
You show up at the registrar's office, and you get your picture taken.
That's it. No documentation of residency?
Very, very limited documentation. In fact, that's why this ID should not be used as identification for other purposes, like proving your age or other things like that, because it's solely to say that you, the voter, are who you are because of your face, so that it gives the poll worker and a little bit of additional verification that, in fact, the right voter has presented himself or herself. So it actually is not going to be able to be used for other purposes because it doesn't have nearly the amount of scrutiny because the supporting documentation is virtually nothing.
So is it Social Security card? Is it other proof of residency?
I cannot remember the language in the bill exactly what needs to be shown. I think it's just when you register to vote and you fill out your voter registration form and say, this is who I am, and then you sign a affidavit under penalty of perjury to say, this is who I am, whatever documents are required for that voter registration, which are very minimal, I think just saying where you live, you get a picture taken. That's your ID, and that can be used for proof for voting.
I have the final minutes with Governor McDonald, 877-336-1035.
Governor, I want to ask you about medical marijuana and the status of that in Virginia. As you know, it's legal now in the District of Columbia. Now the Maryland House of Delegates approving a bill this week that would legalize it. That vote is now being sent to the Senate, where senators will give it careful consideration during the last few weeks of their 90-day session. We have poll numbers that show 72% of Virginians supporting legalizing medical marijuana. And Adrian on Facebook, on our WTOP Facebook page, wants to know that now that Drew on our Facebook page wants to know whether Virginia will consider legalizing medical marijuana.
Well, Deb, you know, I believe that bill has been taken up for years and years and years in Virginia and has always been repudiated. I can say that as the science gets perhaps more developed about the legitimate medical uses of cannabinoids to be able to treat pain and suffering, let's say for cancer patients, and protocols maybe get developed for controls, it's certainly possible at some point Virginia changes the law. It's just not something I've spent a lot of time recently studying, and that policy has just never been approved in Virginia.
Governor, I want to ask you about drones. A couple months ago, we talked about this. It wasn't on the radar screen, literally. And yet now there is a bill which you have made some changes to. Talk about the changes in specifics.
Sure.
That before it was an outright two-year moratorium, I believe.
Yes.
How have you changed that?
Well, the moratorium that the General Assembly recommended was 2 years, but solely related to law enforcement until some of the privacy, civil libertarian concerns can be addressed. And I share this. I mean, obviously, we want to use every possible technology, and I said this on the show before, every possible technology to allow our law enforcement to catch bad guys and save people and so forth. But we want to make sure that as these emergent technologies come out, that we address privacy concerns. So the two things that I've done and the two couple things that I've done in the bill, one is to make sure that we didn't eliminate its use even now for search and rescue missions, case in Alabama where they were used to save a young kid, or when a person's life is essentially in imminent danger. I mean, I think everybody would agree, if we got the technology and it can help, let's do it. But for the other, any other concerns, well, let's study it. And so I've again added a clause in there to say that for the next year, the Department of Criminal Justice Services will help facilitate promulgating what those rules should be for law enforcement, working with all the proper agencies. And then finally, I've made it clear that it doesn't apply to private sector or universities that are engaged in research. We certainly don't want to slow down the technology development and the job creation. Let's let them do it. But this isn't law enforcement use. It's development. For instance, Virginia Tech's got a permit to actually fly these things already, and they're doing a lot of R&D, and it's bringing in a lot of resources to the university. We ought to continue the advancement of knowledge and development, but we just don't put it into the law enforcement sphere until the rules are set.
Governor, we want to ask you about apparently a change that you have made regarding the prohibition of abortion coverage through the insurance plans that would be set up through the federal health exchanges that are part of the Obama health care plan. Explain your decision there and why you've made the change.
Sure. 2 years ago, when we were looking at having a state-based exchange potentially under the federal health care law, the General Assembly approved an amendment that I submitted saying that with the state health-based exchanges that they would not be able to provide abortion coverage. All I've done now that Virginia has opted to have a federal exchange, we're not going to have a state exchange, we're going to have a federal exchange, is to have that same language apply to a federal exchange. So I would look at it as just making the law similar for federal and state-based exchanges.
Are there any exceptions in the coverage?
No, because the way I looked at it, and the General Assembly agreed, and it was a bipartisan vote, was it's similar to what we do with the Hyde Amendment, which we've adopted a couple of years ago, where we don't provide state funding for abortion. That's the federal law. That's now the state law in Virginia. There's only a couple exceptions, rape, incest, and life of the mother, and maybe one other one. But we don't pay for those. And so we shouldn't have an exchange that we pay in part for or by federal dollars that we pay for that has that kind of coverage as well. So that's the logic. And again, it's just applying essentially the same language to federal exchanges that we've already passed 2 years ago for state exchanges.
And it doesn't allow for optional riders. If insurance company wanted to offer that, they can't do that either.
Well, I guess they could buy that maybe separately. It just wouldn't be something, a product listed on the exchange, Mark, I think is the way it's written.
All right, Governor, the hour went by really fast.
It did.
As we discussed all the transportation changes. Look forward to talking with you next month.
Okay. Thanks.
Governor-